Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 4th, 2020. This is class 32-1 of our 32-class structured study of True Vipassana. This is the first of two classes on the Anapanasati Sutta that concludes our study. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
A few logistical things. Does everybody realize that the newsletter is now sent on Sundays and Thursdays?
Yes. Thank you for that.
Thank you, John.
And after that uprising last Saturday.
Sorry about that.
Well, it was a Gandhi-esque uprising. So. And you noticed Wednesday's email about the New Year's message?
Yes.
Did everybody listen to that, I hope?
Mm-hmm.
it sets up the year, I think, rather nicely, what we're going to be doing, which is more of the same. And so today is the penultimate class of our 4-month Vipassana structured study. These last two classes today and Tuesday are on the Anapanasati Sutta, which is, we were talking a little bit earlier about it. Dad even brought it up. It's again one of the most misunderstood suttas, probably because people, you take the name Anapanasati means breath awareness or breath mindfulness, and so that the name became a meditation label, meaning people started calling mostly anything they did with the breath as meditation, as Anapanasati meditation. In fact, the very first class I ever taught, which was right next door here, by the way, that was the first Cross River Meditation Center before it even had a name. The person that I was doing, I started teaching meditation to raise money for charity, and the person put out a flyer saying, "The most magnificent John Haspel, John Haspel will be teaching Anapanasati meditation." No, I'm not teaching that. But it's commonly thought of as a meditation practice, where we'll see Anapanasati, breath awareness, is the Buddha's using the title as an example of accomplished monks who rooted their practice in jhana, or mindfulness of the breath meditation, and then incorporated from that well-concentrated mind the rest of the practice. And so you'll see the first, the Buddha describes how this is established in the four foundations of mindfulness, and then how accomplished wise disciples will then apply it in very specific ways. Again, there's nothing ambiguous about this sutta. It's just pure Dhamma, and it's the most clear and complete description of what a Dhamma practice looks like. Again, using examples of accomplished monks and nuns and accomplished Dhamma practitioners, which, by the way, is exactly what we do here. One of the reasons why this is such a unique Sangha in the world today is because for the same reason it was during the Buddha's time. We only practice what the Buddha taught, and we support each other in doing that. We are examples for each other. And that is really remarkable. It's something, again, that Dad mentioned earlier today. It's rare in the world. So I'll cover about half of it today, and we'll finish this up on Tuesday. And then a week from today, we're going to start the Truth of Happiness course that we do every year. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya 118, the Anapanasati Sutta. I have heard that on one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Savatthi in the Eastern Monastery. This was during Upasota day of the full moon. That was a day of the full moon that was devoted towards, I don't know how you could call it, increased focus on Dhamma practice, although they were pretty well focused back then. It was just a day. Many people make a big deal out of that even today. It was just another day. Many of the elder disciples were with him. Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Moggallana, Kassapa, Mahakakana, Kotita, Kapina, Mahakunda, Ravata, Ananda, and many others. Those people, the reason why I said is they deserve to have their names recognized 2,600 years later, I think. During this time, the elder monks were teaching the Dhamma. They were each teaching novice monks with groups ranging in size from 10 to as large as 40. This was a common way of teaching that carried on after the Buddha's passing and was so important in maintaining the Dhamma by following this example that the Buddha established. After the Buddha died, they first had their first Buddhist council, and Ananda, and I can't think of the other gentleman's name right now, recited what they heard the Buddha teach. And Ananda and the other gentleman, they both had word-perfect memories. And so even the beginning of the sutta, thus I have I heard, that's Ananda saying, this is what I heard. And then it was checked by all the other monks that were in attendance at that first council. And so they all agreed, yeah, I heard that, and it was in that setting, et cetera, et cetera. That was the establishment of the Sutta Pitaka from 2,600 years ago. And because of the way that it was then practiced, it's been maintained. In other words, monks and pretty shortly afterwards, nuns who had developed certain aspects of the Dhamma were then given the task, and they were given groups of novices to then recite what the suttas that have been preserved were. And they did it in these small groups. And look what's occurring here today. Exactly the same thing. The new monks were learning quickly and correctly, meaning the ones that were being taught. The Buddha arrived and was seated in the open air, surrounded by the community of monks. Surveying the silent community that impressed him, he addressed them. Monks, I am pleased with what is taking place here, and the dedication to develop the Dhamma and the realization of Nibbana, awakening, full human maturity. As such, I will remain here at Savatthi for another month through the fourth month of the rain. So they always, and again, this is something that's made overplayed. But during the Buddha's time in that part of northern India and southern Nepal, every year they got torrential rains, a monsoon season, that typically lasted 3 months. And since it was foolish and nearly impossible to do what they did the other 9 months, which was travel around spreading the Dhamma, they just stayed in one place. And that's led to an overemphasis on long retreats. In other words, a three-month retreat, which was founded during the Buddha's time in practicality, now becomes something that we do as part of Dhamma practice. It was just a practical reason for staying in one place during those 3 months. And so now the Buddha sees that the younger monks and nuns are taking so well to the Dhamma, he decides to stay there one more month. I think out of curiosity, because he's impressed. He wants to see what's going on. The monks in the surrounding countryside heard this and left for Savatthi to join the Buddha and that Sangha. A short time later, the Buddha addressed the large but quiet community. The second reference to quiet, isn't it? Noble silence. Monks, this community of monks is free from idle chatter and is established in pure heartwood. Anytime the Buddha uses the word heartwood, he's talking about the Eightfold Path. This community is worthy of gifts and worthy of hospitality. That he's not imploring them to start throwing gold and silver at the monks. He's saying because of what they've accomplished in the Dhamma, they're worthy of support. This community is worthy of offerings and worthy of respect. This community will bring much good for the world. It still is. Due to their establishment in the heartwood of the Dhamma, when a small gift is given to the community, it becomes great, and a great gift even greater. This community of monks is rare to see in the world. Think about that. Even during the Buddha's time, with the Buddha himself teaching the Dhamma, a well-focused Sangha, actually practicing what the Buddha taught and nothing else, was rare to see in the world. And we know it still is. And that's not good, bad, or anything. That is just the nature of the phenomenal world. A well-focused Sangha is rare in the world. It was 2,600 years ago. It still is today. There's no reason to even think that, well, that should be different and everybody in the world should be practicing the Buddhist Dhamma. I kind of think that'd be wonderful, but it's not realistic to even think go that far. It's enough that we're practicing the Dhamma. Why? Because that's the only thing that we can do as individuals is develop the Dhamma. We talked a little bit about this last week, but as we start diminishing conflict within ourselves, simultaneously we're diminishing conflict in the world simply because we're not contributing to it anymore. This community of monks is such that it would be worth traveling for leagues, or at least for Philadelphia, taking along provisions in order to learn from. In this community of monks, there are monks who are arahants. Arahants are simply awakened human beings. Arahants are awakened human beings who have fully developed the Eightfold Path and whose mental effluence have ended. These arahants have completed the task and have laid down the burden of continued eye-making. They have attained the true goal and abandoned the fetter of becoming further ignorant. They are released through right understanding. Right view is another word for right understanding. Such is this community of monks. In this community of monks, there are monks who, abandoning the five lower fetters, are totally unbound from clinging to ignorant views. From abandoning the five lower fetters, I'll say what those are in a minute, their minds are continually resting in equanimity. You'll see that the five lower fetters are nothing that we want to hang on to anyway, except a mind rooted in ignorance does find value in these. It allows it to continue its own ignorance. Such are the monks in this community of monks. The five lower fetters are self-referential views. Grasping at rituals and practices that only continue, is my little comment there, grasping at rituals and practices that only continue self-referential views. Even during the Buddha's time, he understood the foolishness and the distraction of embellishing a Dhamma practice with rites and rituals that have nothing to do with developing the cessation of ignorance and continued eye-making. In fact, the ritual itself encourages continued eye-making. It's always done for a reason to achieve something. Now, I've had people and some students that argue that point, saying that repetitive bowing, such as 100 times before you meditate, helps focus the mind. Well, maybe, but you're still relying on an outside agency to help focus your mind rather than what the Buddha taught. Simply sit, be quiet, and be mindful of your breath. And it's another way of conditioning myself to think that I need to figure out a Dhamma that's specific to me. In other words, some people don't need to do this, but because I need it, because my mind is so distracted, I got to do these special rituals or these special practices or these special chants. It's just compensation for continued eye-making. It can only continue eye-making. Buddha continues with the five fetters. Uncertainty or lack of conviction, doubt, one of the five hindrances, isn't it? Craving for sensory stimulation, again, one of the hindrances. Ill will towards oneself or others, those are the five fetters. Is there anything in here that we don't feel that there's value in maintaining? Of course there isn't. These are all things that are true fetters. As human beings, they affect us in a negative way. But because our minds are rooted in ignorance and prone to ignoring the results of our own ignorance, that's how it's maintained, we see these things as almost unassailable problems. We can't really address them because we can't unless we have the proper framework. A simple thing like changing from being conditionally prone towards sensory stimulation, it does seem like annihilation. It seems like almost anti-being human, anti-humanity to recognize and abandon the craving for self-centered sensory stimulation in each and every moment. But that's all it is. It's just letting go of the very craving that distracts us from our own life. The five fetters, let's say it again, self-referential views, grasping at rituals and practices, uncertainty or doubt, craving for sensory stimulation, and ill will towards oneself or others. In this community of monks, there are monks who, abandoning the first three fetters and with a diminishing of passion, aversion, and deluded thinking, three defilements, have established a heartwood and will make an ending to stress. They are in the stream of the Dhamma. The stream mentor is another misunderstood, usually given mystical terms. It simply means we're practicing the Dhamma. And any human being that actually takes to the Dhamma is a stream enterer. There's nothing magical or mystical about it. And you can lose the stream by stopping practicing the Dhamma. There's nothing, the reason why I'm saying that is there's traditions that say once you enter the stream, the end is for sure. I've seen many people, we've had a lot of people come here and entered the stream and decided that that stream was too cold for them or too hot for them, whatever it was. It wasn't for them. You have to stay in your boat. You have to stay in the Dhamma if you're going to get to the far shore, as the Buddha puts it. Developing the cessation of suffering, their minds inclined towards awakening. Such are the monks in this community of monks. In this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to the development of the four frames of reference, or the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right exertions, the four bases of power, the five faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening, and the Noble Eightfold Path. Such are the monks in this community of monks. Some of those references might seem a little bit arcane, but they're actually a part of normal Dhamma practice. They're just referenced a little bit different way here in the sutta. The four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha tells us. These senior monks, these accomplished monks have done this, and that's what the Buddha is holding them out as example. The four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, mindful of the breath and the body. So we begin to establish the four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, every time we sit and meditate and become mindful of the breath and the body. That's the first foundation of mindfulness. We've talked about this quite a few times in relation to jhana. This is the beginning of the establishment of a jhana practice, the first foundation of mindfulness. It makes sense when you put the words together, doesn't it? The foundation of all of this, of the entire Dhamma, rest in that first foundation. If we don't do that, meaning if we don't do right meditation or jhana meditation, there's no Dhamma. There can't be, because we're doing something else. The next foundation of mindfulness, and we do this in every meditation session, is mindful of feelings arising and passing away. That simple act of recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts, and our thoughts are the same as feelings in that sense, caught up in our feelings and thoughts, notice it, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's what the Buddha is referring to. In other words, instead of analyzing our feelings or thinking that we should engage in endless insight meditation practices, meaning whatever comes up, we start looking at it and get a feel for it and take it to its end and analyze it and describe it to ourselves. That's not meditation. That's something else. Today it's called vipassana, but we know that the Buddha used that word completely different. Vipassana referring to gaining introspective insight into the three marks of existence through a jhana practice. The next foundation of mindfulness is mindful of thoughts arising and passing away, feelings arising and passing away, thoughts arising and passing away. And finally, being mindful of the present but impermanent quality of mind. And so even as meditators, as we start developing that, we begin to notice the different qualities of our mind in relation to reacting to feelings or thoughts or not, or maintaining a mindful present within ourselves, inner poise. And so then they're not affecting us. And even if there's some disturbances in our life, with right meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the disturbances in our life don't affect, excuse me. The disturbances or the stressors in our life don't affect the quality of our mind. You heard me say it often, that we learn how to be peaceful with less than peaceful mind states. In other words, we understand this what's occurring right now is as impermanent as anything else, including my thoughts about what's occurring right now. So let me bring my mind back into my body. Let me take a breath. Reestablish that foundations of mindfulness that I initially established in meditation and bring it here and now into this present moment. That's Dhamma practice. That's what the Buddha is using as an example. He's saying, all of these monks do this. If you want to be like them, if you want to be like Johnny, you'll do it the way Johnny does it. If we want to be like the Buddha, we'll do it the way the Buddha does it. That's why this is such a significant sutta. It's an example of how to do it. The four right efforts. Avoiding inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. How do we do that? We can only do it through concentration. Abandoning inappropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have arisen. Again, only with concentration. It's the only way we'll notice it occurring within ourselves. And that's something we talk about all the time, isn't it? The difference in our in ourselves as we develop the Dhamma in relation to what's occurring externally and internally. We do it all the time. Developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. And maintaining appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds for continual development of non-confusion and skillful qualities that have arisen. Those last two lines, maintaining appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds for continual development of non-confusion and skillful qualities and developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds. How do we do that? How do we develop appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen? The Buddha is referring to conditioning our minds towards awakening. And we do it through the framework of the Eightfold Path. How else could we do it? Developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. It's all framed by right speech, right intention, etc., etc., etc. And the last part, maintaining, is also done within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Does everybody get that?
Has yet arisen? Is that in the past or the future?
It's in the future. The Buddha's talking about has yet to arisen to manifest.
I have problems with that too, with the way that it's stated here.
The verbiage?
Yeah. For instance, in the first one, the deeds that have yet arisen, to me that would be the deeds that have not yet arisen. That would be clear.
It would.
And because then the second one, the deeds that have arisen, that's clear.
Have yet arisen or have not yet arisen? Isn't it the same thing though?
No, it's English.
It's English stuff.
Yeah. Have yet. It's the. How is it grammatical?
What's the
and
correct?
I'm not sure. I'm not super familiar with it.
How is it stated now?
How can these teachers?
Yet. I know. Yeah. English. She's the English teacher.
Yes. So.
Is there an English major in the
room? Well, or could it just be both? Is
had that, yet.
Wouldn't it be have yet to arise?
I have to hear it again.
Arisen's past.
Have yet arisen. Have not yet.
Actually, the actual way to say that is have yet to have arisen.
No, arise.
Arise.
Arisen is in the past.
Arisen's past tense.
Well, this is past perfect, though.
It's in the future.
I mean, a future perfect. Have yet to have arisen.
Have yet to have arisen. Okay.
Have yet to have arisen.
I'll make the adjustments.
I thought it was had yet arisen.
What did you say first?
Developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet. Wait. Developing appropriate thoughts, words, and deeds that have yet arisen. That's not grammatically correct?
No.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Still sounds good to me.
Have yet to have.
All right. I'll address it. Back to the Dhamma.
I'll go check it in my book.
Okay. This next section is called the Four Bases of Power. This is where all of our power as human beings come from. Calm, rooted in concentration. Notice how many times the Buddha comes back to a proper jhana practice and establishing concentration in many different ways. Persistence, rooted in that concentration. Right intention, rooted in concentration. And wisdom, rooted in concentration. So you hear me emphasize the importance of right meditation or jhana meditation often. This is why, because the Buddha mentions it often. And again, imagine the scene. We're back there 2,600 years ago. Everything is the same, except you were there. The Buddha's talking to people just like us. And he's saying over and over again, it's concentration. Deepen your concentration. If you want to be like these accomplished monks, deepen your concentration. Do jhana. The five faculties of Dhamma practice. Conviction, which relates to right effort. Enthusiastic engagement, that relates to right view and right intention. Right mindfulness, knowing what to hold in mind. Again, the Buddha doesn't teach this broad grasp after everything type of mindfulness. It's very specific, refined mindfulness. Concentration and wisdom. Those are the five powers. Conviction, enthusiastic engagement, right mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. The five strengths are conviction. These also relate to taking true refuge. Conviction, meaning that we're not taking anything on faith here. I think it was Deb, we had a discussion a little bit about this last week. And it was just, and I don't think I got, you sent me an email, Ted, and I didn't get back to you, sorry, about this. And it is a little bit of semantics, depending on what we're holding in our own minds. But there's nothing taken in faith in the Buddha's Dhamma. Everything is taken by conviction, because we understand that a human being did this, he figured it out, he left his teaching, and we have a well-focused Sangha to practice that in. It's all practical teachings. The five strengths again. Conviction in the Buddha, meaning that we understand a human being did this. Conscience, having a conscience, which means, it means regret at misconduct in thought, word, and deed, but not in a way that we're beating ourselves up. It's just that we understand how hurtful that is to ourselves and towards other people, but in a completely non-self-judgmental way. It's just practical teaching. Why would I want to keep hurting myself and others when I know now that I'm doing it? Persistence, meaning persistence for integrating the Eightfold Path as the framework for mindfulness. Wisdom or discernment, meaning penetrating understanding to the arising and passing away of suffering and all phenomena, being mindfully present with life as life unfolds. Discernment is the ability to see things appropriately within the appropriate context. So again, if we're going to, that's a bit of my commentary I left in there. If we're going to develop discernment or true wisdom, it has to be framed by something, doesn't it? And the true wisdom that's developed through the Eightfold Path is framed by the Eightfold Path, not through a ninefold path or a threefold path or a onefold path, meaning just meditation, which is, you know, that's a lot of people's practice is just do meditate. I mean, that's kind of Zen practice. That arose out of something called the Yogacara school, not related too much to modern yoga. It simply means the mind-only school, and that was a school that developed into Zen or the other variants of that, that is focused mostly on just a meditation method, and it's not usually not even jhana meditation. It's more than just meditation. The seven factors of awakening. Seven factors of awakening are mindfulness, penetrating investigation into the Dhamma. We just went through that four-week study of Vipassana. That's what that was. Enthusiasm. We have a lot of it here. Rapture. It's an archaic word, but it simply means joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Calm, concentration, and equanimity. The Noble Eightfold Path is right view or right understanding, right intention or right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, meaning ongoing mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, as taught in the Satipatthana Sutta. Right meditation or jhana meditation, the Buddha continues, in this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to the development of goodwill and compassion, to concern and equanimity. They understand the relentless decay of the body and the impermanence, the arising and passing away of all conditioned things. Such are the monks in this community of monks. In this community of monks, there are monks who remain devoted to mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath. Again, referencing back to a proper jhana practice. They are devoted to it. That's what their life is about. It's what our lives are about, by the way. And it doesn't mean that all you do is spend your days thinking about your in-breath and your out-breath, but that's the foundation. That's the anchor to reality, isn't it, for all of us? And when we lose it, we've trained ourselves, take a breath, get my mind back into my body, be here for what's occurring rather than what I might be afraid of or grasping after. Buddha continues, mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath, when appropriate developed, is of great benefit. Mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath, when appropriate developed, supports the concentration necessary that brings the four foundations of mindfulness to their culmination. Over and over again, the Buddha is emphasizing to these novices, develop concentration, and do it with the right method. Friends, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the cessation of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the establishing of the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. In other words, these four foundations of mindfulness. Again, coming back to that initial establishment that we all do in our right meditation practice. The four foundations of mindfulness, when appropriately developed, bring the seven factors for awakening to their culmination. Appropriate mindfulness brings these, and we'll touch on that. You've heard me teach this before. It is appropriate mindfulness resting in jhana meditation that develops these seven factors that are necessary for awakening. The seven factors for awakening, when appropriately developed, brings clear knowing or right understanding or right view and release from clinging to wrong or ignorant views to their culmination. The next section is called mindfulness of in and out breathing. Now,
Yes. Can you slow down a bit?
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Now, how is mindfulness of in and out breathing appropriate developed so to be of great benefit? How do we do it? A monk having gone to the wilderness or a secluded spot, to the shade of a tree or to an empty building, sits down, folding his legs crosswise. That's not necessary for meditation practice. It's simply how they sat. Holding his body erect and setting mindfulness to the fore, which means setting mindfulness to the breath in the body. Always mindful of the breath, he breathes in. Always mindful of the breath, he breathes out. This is where many people have taken great license with this sutta and the Satipatthana Sutta and manipulate it, I should say, alter it and embellish it in a way that changes the practice itself into something that is more breath exaggeration meditation than simple and gentle mindfulness. The Buddha never taught to manipulate the breath in any way, yet there are many, many practices that teach, and I've been there, that meditation, you should spend some time meditating on long forced breaths and then short forced breaths and this and that. And you'll hear later on, I think it's in the Satipatthana Sutta, the meditation on eternal grounds. And people have made meditation about call it meditation, but you're thinking about what happens when a body dies and decays and rots. That's not why the Buddha taught that. He simply taught that so people understand, why are you so enamored with this thing? At best, it's going to end up like that, rotting with birds picking at it. It was never meant to be a meditation. And think about that. Why would an awakened human being teach somebody to meditate on something like that rather than just understand it through the practice? When breathing in long, this is referencing what I just said. When breathing in long, they notice I am breathing in long. He doesn't teach you to breathe in long and make a practice of it. It's just as your breath is naturally occurring in this moment, and it's different every time we meditate, breathe in long. That's what you're breathing. Just notice it, that you're breathing in long. Or when breathing in short, he notices I am breathing in short. It simply means we're noticing our breath. Or when breathing out short, he notices I am breathing out short. He trains himself. I will breathe in sensitive to the entire body. What does that mean? This is another where people made variants of yoga nidra, which is a wonderful practice, by the way, but they brought variants of yoga nidra into this breath scanning and call that jhana meditation. The Buddha is saying here to simply be sensitive that you have a body. And when you understand the rest of the Dhamma, especially the Satipatthana Sutta, that makes perfect sense. Concentration can only be when we are sensitive, meaning we are aware that we're in a body. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is hardly ever in its body. That's the problem. That's why there's always stress, because it's either stuck in the past or stuck in the future, or in the present moment is disappointed because it's not distracted enough. It's never here. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to the entire body. Again, noticing I have a body. He trains himself, I will breathe in, calming bodily fabrications. The intention isn't to breathe in and calm a bodily fabrication. As I breathe in, as I do jhana meditation, bodily fabrications, disturbances within the body, simply calm. It's a consequence of right meditation, not a consequence of directed thought towards calming fabrications. Do you notice a difference? It's just breath meditation. Excuse me. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming bodily fabrication. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to rapture. Again, It's not grasping after rapture. It's just sensitive, means that I am aware of it. I'm aware that I am joyfully engaged in my Dhamma practice. That's important. And again, we talk about this all the time, to be mindful of our practice and the benefits of it, to hold that in mind, to recognize it, recognize the benefits that are developing for us as individuals. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to rapture. I'm in my body. I'm joyfully engaged in the Dhamma. What the Buddha is referring to. These are the things that occur in coming back to the sensation of breathing. It's not I'm not devoting a meditation practice to simply generating feelings of joyful engagement. I notice it as part of what's occurring within me. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to rapture. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to pleasure. Doesn't mean I'm grasping after pleasure. It means that I'm sensitive to it. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. It's when I start creating an identity over it or insist that I have it, something I describe as pleasurable to myself right now. But as an awakened human being, I'm sensitive when it comes down the pike, aren't I? And that establishment of pleasure takes on much more subtle, mundane, but meaningful ways in that way, because it's simply life as life occurs. And every moment is meaningful. Why? Because I'm here for it. It doesn't take an extreme event to bring me back into my life. Each and every moment in that way is an extreme event because I'm simply mindful of it. It has meaning in this moment, whatever it is. And it could be something that a week ago used to drive me crazy in frustration or fear or anger. And now I simply understand this is human life. That's what a mature human being does, don't they? That's what the Buddha teaches, is how to be a fully mature, fully aware, fully awakened human being. And it's characterized by just this, being at peace, no matter what. That fourth foundation of mindfulness, being at peace with what might be a less than peaceful mind state. Things don't have to be any different than they are because they can't be. He trains himself. I will breathe out, sensitive to pleasure. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to mental fabrications. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to mental fabrications. Simply means that I'm aware of it. He trains himself, I will breathe in, calming mentally fabrications. As I breathe in, mental fabrications calm. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming mental fabrications. I'm not directing myself to calm a bodily fabrication. It's the result of right jhana practice, that mental, verbal, and bodily fabrications diminish. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to the mind. It simply means I'm aware that I have a mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe in, calming the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, calming the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe in, steadying the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, steadying the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe in, releasing the mind. Releasing it from what? The Vitakasanthana Sutta says that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. What has that got to do with releasing the mind? Remember the context. I'm releasing a mind that's rooted in ignorance. And I'm gaining a mind that has the ability to think what it wants to think whenever it wants to think it, meaning whatever is appropriate. Releasing the mind. I'm releasing that troubled, anguished mind that is prone to stress and suffering, prone to self-referential views, prone to greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. What am I letting go of? Nothing. Nothing worth hanging on to anyway.
You're releasing the clinging part of the mind.
Yeah. That's what the Buddha is referring to. And I don't want to get too deep into it, but you'll remember from dependent origination, I think it's the seventh or eighth factor, it directly relates to that, isn't it? And of course, all the Dhamma relates to dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths. He trains himself, I will breathe out, releasing the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on inconstancy. It's focusing, again, it doesn't mean this an intense focus. It simply means being mindful of the impermanence of all things, including my thoughts. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on inconstancy or impermanence. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on dispassion, meaning noticing how that my passion for maintaining self-referential views is diminishing. Dispassion is gaining. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on dispassion, noticing it. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on cessation. He trains himself, I will breathe out, focusing on cessation. Meaning holding in mind that this is where I'm moving to. I'm moving to the cessation of all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. He trains himself. And let me just mention something. I usually try to make my retranslations non-gender specific for obvious reasons. But there's some suttas that's just inappropriate, and there's no mention of nuns anywhere. And this is probably a relatively early sutta, so likely before nuns were part of the Sangha, the original Sangha. And so that's why I left it that way and not non-gender specific. But the Buddha's saying, again, to this group, this is how they train themselves. He trains himself, I will breathe in, focusing on relinquishment. Relinquishment of what? Of what? What's the Dhamma about? Relinquishment of ignorant views. I didn't slow down much, did I?
No.
When
I've given up.
You can keep reminding. I get like you know when I got a lot that I like to get done, I start going too fast. But you can do what just throw a shoe at me. He trains himself. I will breathe out, focusing on relinquishment. This is how mindfulness of in and out breathing is developed and pursued so as to be of great benefit. The four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, coming back to that. Now, how is mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath appropriately developed so as to bring the four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, to their culmination? On whatever occasion, a monk breathing in long is mindful of breathing in long, or breathing out long is mindful of breathing out long, or breathing in short is mindful of breathing in short, or breathing out short is mindful of breathing out short. They continue to train their mind. So again, the Buddha's, there must have been breath mindfulness cults around during the Buddha's time as well, or he wouldn't be addressing this problem. So he's noticed some confusion between the novice monks and their meditation practices, grasping after these embellished practices and not doing jhana. That's why he's emphasizing it to them. They continue, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the body, bringing mindfulness to the fore, to what is occurring, and uniting the mind within the frame of reference of the breath in the body. Again, just bringing the mind back into the body. He trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, calming bodily fabrications. On this occasion, meaning when this occurs, the monk remains focused on the breath in the body in and of itself, which is a reference, meaning in and of itself means in that moment, this mind is free of distraction. There's nothing else occurring. It's just in and of itself. I am mindful of the breath in the body in and of itself. There's nothing else occurring in this moment. Ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. That's what we're doing in that, in our meditation practice. We come in, we sit. I'm letting go of all of that distracting thoughts, and I'm uniting my mind and my body. Feelings arise and pass away, my mind stays in the body. Thoughts arise and pass away, my mind stays in the body. The quality of mind starts to calm. Mind stays in the body. I'm living my life now, aren't I? I have found a way to reunite my mind and my body. And I'm staying mindfully present for life as life occurs. It's the only way we can experience life. That's why the Buddha calls a life rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths as a death-like state. And he refers to an awakened human being as having achieved the deathless state, meaning there's no longer ignorance. It doesn't mean that we're going to live forever. It simply means we're finally living. I tell you, monks, the in and out breath is unsurpassed as a body among bodies. What does that mean? It's a rather ambiguous. It simply means that all of the speculative ideas that I've made about myself. I'm here, I'm there. All the different worldly bodies that I've made. There's nothing like uniting the body back in the body. This is the body among all those bodies. And it's also a reference in the Buddha. When the Buddha's talking about bodies, he's talking about the world. And so what we've done in meditation is I've united my mind into my body, and I'm no longer entangled with the bigger body, the bodies of the world. I've established seclusion in my mind and in my life. On the occasion that one remains focused on the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, they are putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. When we're doing that, on any occasion, a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to rapture. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to pleasure. And again, it doesn't mean we're grasping after these. We're just sensitive that they might occur. Come back to the breath. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to mental fabrications. I will breathe in and breathe out, calming mental fabrication. On this occasion, when this occurs, the monk remains focused on feelings, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. The Buddha's telling us right there directly, what do we do with feelings? Nothing. Come back to the breath. I tell you, monks, that mindfulness of in-breaths and out-breaths can be seen as a single feeling among feelings, which is why the monk on this occasion remains focused on feelings free of distraction. Again, a little bit ambiguous and confusing. Let me finish it. Ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Again, the Buddha is just teaching us to be mindfully present with a feeling as it occurs. It's just a feeling among feelings. And if it's just that feeling that's occurring and I'm not attaching it to or clinging it to other feelings or letting the feeling cause a reaction that then causes a conditioned reference to other feelings or other people or other situations, I'm out of my mind now, aren't I? But just being mindful of the feeling as a feeling amongst feelings is the same as a body among bodies. It's just this feeling. It's just what's occurring right now. It has nothing to do with a past or a future feeling. This feeling that I'm occurring, that's occurring within me right now, cannot influence the next moment. Cannot influence the next moment unless I insist that it does. Because it's just a feeling among feelings. And all feelings are impermanent. And the only way for me to interpret a feeling realistically, accurately, and safely is to be established in the four frames of reference so I know what I'm referencing. Otherwise, I'm interpreting a feeling through a mind rooted in ignorance, and that can only continue ignorance. This is the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma, to understand this one point, to understand the eye-making at the point of contact. The only way to do that is to develop concentration and the framework, the Eightfold Path, to understand what's occurring right now as my life occurs. Does everybody follow?
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody not? Please tell me if you don't, because it's such an important point. Nobody's confused about this point?
No.
Okay. This is why I keep saying, why the Buddha keeps referencing. The Dhamma is practiced in this moment. Whenever a monk trains himself.
John.
Yes.
I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
Okay.
I did have a question or clarification I wanted to explore, but I'll let you finish your thought.
Don't lose it, though. Write it down or something. Well, you'll remember. You're well concentrated to things. Whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to the mind. They remain focused on the mind, free of distraction, sensitive to the mind. Just being mindful of what's occurring within the mind. Ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, satisfying the mind. That simple act, all the grasping after that my mind wanted in before to be satisfied. Satisfied is the opposite of dukkha, is a good description, is unsatisfied or dissatisfied. Satisfying the mind in this way is just that simple act of breathing in. I breathe in, I breathe out. It satisfies the mind. Why? Why does that work? Why is my mind satisfied when I breathe in, when I'm mindful of breathing in?
Because you're concentrated.
Yeah, because you're back in your body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are where you are.
Yeah. And so a human being, you know, the Buddha teaches every human, he doesn't say that we should live ascetic lives. In fact, he teaches just the opposite. He said every human being needs four things: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. But beyond that can be grasping and clinging to those things. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have them or have a nice house or a couple of cars. That's okay, as long as you don't self-identify with them, as long as you don't need them to be happy. That's what the Buddha is referring to. The only thing that a human being needs to be happy is to be in his body, to be present for his own life. The great secret, you know that book that came out 10 years ago or whatever it was, The Secret? The secret to happiness is to be in your life. How else could it be? How could happiness be established in a fabricated, conditioned way of looking at the world? An abstract view, which, by the way, is what most of philosophy is about, is developing an abstract view, rather than having an ongoing moment-by-moment experience of my life. What could be more fulfilling than that? And I can tell you it is, and you're all feeling that. You're all realizing that when you're present for what's occurring, no matter what it is, no matter how mundane it might be, that's the most fulfilling times of your life. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Buddha continues. I will breathe in and breathe out, steadying the mind. I will breathe in and breathe out, releasing the mind. There remain focus on the mind, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. When this occurs, the monk remains mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. There's that reference again to that, while putting aside. It's an intentional act. It's part of right intention. I recognize my craving. I don't analyze it. I don't struggle with it. When I see it, I simply put it aside. Not always easy to do, but that's what is done. I do not say that there is a development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful of these instructions or modifies them, or who is not fully aware of these instructions. You have to learn it. Whenever a monk trains himself, I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to impermanence. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to dispassion. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to cessation. I will breathe in and breathe out, sensitive to relinquishment. On this occasion, meaning when this occurs, this monk remains sensitive to all mental qualities, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. Those who see with wisdom and understanding, meaning right view, the relinquishment, the abandonment of craving and distress, are those who have established right mindfulness with equanimity. Again, referencing back to the Eightfold Path and developing right mindfulness, right concentration. In other words, recognizing wrong mindfulness, what's wrong to hold in mind. When this occurs, this person remains mindful of all mental qualities, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside craving and distress with reference to the world. This is how mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath is appropriately developed, so as to bring the four frames of reference, the four foundations of mindfulness, to their culmination. I thought that was where it wanted to end. I'm going to stop there today. I think that's enough, huh? there's a lot, and I know I went through it quickly. Again, the best way to look at this sutta is as an example, as guidance for our own practice. As when we conclude this on Tuesday, you'll be able to hear, again, this is always remarkable to me, how you can feel the Buddha's enthusiasm coming through his suttas, translated a couple dozen times, and it's still there 2,600 years later. The Buddha just say, this is how you do it. Anybody can do it. Just do this. Let go of all the rest of the nonsense and do this one thing, and you'll awaken. It's just remarkable. So let me, the thing, you had a question. Do I need to? Yeah, there you go.
yeah. Thank you very much for that. That's really wonderful. I would like for you to. One of the things that even the tradition that I came from, Wan Buddhism, And I think this is a tradition. This is a kind of popular, well, not popular move. It's a perspective. It seems like the meditation practice is a focus on concentration, and I dig it, of course. I mean, I see it. I mean, it's in the Eightfold Path, you know, right? I see it as right focus or right concentration.
Yeah.
But as you went through the sutta, one finds that it's also about mindfulness as well. Yep. In the meditation practice. Like here's an example, like for me, that kind of clarified for me. And Thanissaro kind of talks about this, that this kind of complete, maybe not bias, that's not the word, this kind of view that it's all about concentration. It's not necessarily so. It is about concentration, but also about mindfulness. Like, for example, if I'm feeling drowsy, and I'm thinking, okay, well, drowsiness is arising, well, drowsiness will pass away. Well, I don't know if that's skillful, because if I'm drowsy, then there's a tendency to me falling asleep in the drowsiness.
Yeah.
I have to be mindful that I'm drowsy and then compensate that with, as you say, as it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, you know, maybe rapture, bringing more pleasurable of being in this meditation practice, in the sense, to compensate the drowsiness so I can come back to equanimity.
Yeah.
So there's and I think we talked about this versus that conditionality, which is fundamental in the Buddhist teaching.
Yep.
That if for example, if drowsiness is arising, that's a condition. So if that's arising, then sleepiness is going to arise as well. There's going to be an effect, and it's going to cause that type of cascade.
Yep.
So if you're going to follow that kind of move, then you need to compensate. You need to make a choice to not fall into that. And so it comes back to that. So I like kind of for you to kind of nuance the understanding of concentration is a part of it. And then there's this mindfulness part of it that's also important, and how both of them are both done on the cushion and off the cushion. Could you explain more about how that kind of moves?
Thank you, Dathane, for such a great question. Going back to what you said about drowsiness. Drowsiness is recognized by the Buddha as one of the hindrances, and it's just another practical teaching that if we find ourselves always drowsy during meditation, drowsiness can be an aspect of aversion. You don't want to do it. You just feel tired. And this happens with you don't want to do the dishes. You tend to get tired and go sit on the couch. The same thing occurs during meditation often. And so it's simply a reaction to aversion to meditation. And Dathane mentioned, remind yourself what you're doing. Reinvigorate yourself with joyful engagement in your Dhamma practice. And that will end drowsiness. And if it still persists, the practical thing to look at is, are you getting enough rest? Because if you find yourself falling asleep often during meditation, you probably aren't. So part of taking care of yourself within the Dhamma is taking care of yourself physically. Dathane wasn't really focusing on it, but that's an important part of it. The other thing that Dathane mentioned, and it's so important, and we talk about it all the time, is the Buddha didn't teach just meditation. He taught meditation, right meditation, to support the refined mindfulness that's necessary to hold in mind the Eightfold Path. And the reason why I call it refined mindfulness is modern mindfulness is taught in a very, very general way, that you should be mindful of whatever is occurring. That's good advice. Although most people can't do it unless they develop concentration first. And then the Buddha teaches it's not the most important thing of mindfulness isn't to be mindful that you're washing the dishes, or be mindful that you're driving the car, or be mindful that you're having a conversation. Be mindful that you're washing the dishes from the framework of the Eightfold Path. That's refined mindfulness. And so it's rooted in concentration, and it's expressed as mindfulness that is framed by the Eightfold Path. So you brought up a very important point, Dathane. I hope I answered your question adequately.
You did.
Good.
Yeah, I have this. I have just one more, and I want to comment on this, and I'm done. I don't want to monopolize. This is something also that Thanissaro talks about, and I find to be, he says that this is a strategy that the Buddha uses. When it comes to being liberated, there is this world of pleasure that we exist in, and we know it's impermanent, it's inconstant, but we crave it and we want to hold on to it. So to tell a person, okay, we know that once you start really getting the point that that is inconstant and that doesn't sustain permanent or sustain happiness, well, stop doing it. Stop going in that direction. So then Cyril says, okay, well, the Buddha has a, like, you know, if that's like heroin. Don't do heroin. Okay, I'm not going to do heroin, so I'm going to go cold turkey. But going cold turkey is such a high curve. I mean, people usually don't go cold turkey. They go back to heroin because it's just too much. I can't. So the Buddha says, okay, if you want to find pleasure in something, find pleasure in the meditation practice. Find pleasure in the jhanas as a transition towards this passion. I feel that, and that's what Thamso talks about. It's like these stages of moving from grasping after worldly pleasure, then more skillful refinement of, okay, I don't want to grasp after that, but let my mind grasp after meditation and jhanas. Then once you get that hold, okay, let me not grasp after that, because that's also inconstant. That, you know, rises and goes in meditation. So now let me mature from that towards equanimity and dispassion. But I just want to make the kind of statement. I like to hear your point of view about how the process of this, of going from heroin to methadone, which is kind of an aspect of the path, towards dispassion, which is getting off of methadone and just being content, satisfied, like you said, in your mind and your body. So why don't you explain more about that?
Again, the thing, thank you. Everybody has a couple hours, right? Yes, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path to do just that. The Eightfold Path is the gentlest path to get off the heroin of my own conditioned views, my clinging to my ignorant views. And it's meant that way. And it's meant to be, the framework of the Eightfold Path provides the ongoing perspective that today I only needed 2 shots of heroin, where yesterday I needed 3. It allows us to note, and that's why we talk about it all the time. When we practice a Dhamma at the point of contact within the framework of the Eightfold Path, we notice that today we only needed 2 shots of heroin where yesterday. We notice that we're increasingly disentangled with the world. And in this, using the metaphor that Thane did and I just did, the world is the heroin. It's what we're craving. It's what we're clinging to. It is a drug in that way. And it is. My mindfulness started to develop initially with a 12-step program. And as it continued and I started working with more and more people, I realized that we're all addicted in some way to something. If it's not a substance, it's simply the world and our own views of ourselves in relation to the world. That's our heroin. And the Buddha taught this wonderfully gentle way of getting off the drugs of our own thoughts, our own thinking. So thank you for bringing that up to things. Great. Let me go to Thad, but I know...
I got to roll.
Yeah, so look, what do you got to say for yourself before you go? I was going to say, anybody got to leave?
Well, this sutta was the first one that I grabbed onto just because intellectually it let me chew on a lot of lists and a lot of concepts. But the most important thing that this sutta brought me was it taught me how to be a sangha member and how to conduct myself and how to create a rigor.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Bye. There's some chocolate pie out there too. So it's 10:00. So maybe, and we have a big group. So why don't we see what Ram has to say, and maybe we won't go around the room today. We'll just. But.
Yes. I was a bit daunted by this one, but it again breaks down to the Dhamma being practiced one breath at a time. And one part of the Eightfold Path at a time. But what the Thane just mentioned about this finding the pleasure, and there are mentions elsewhere about balancing that pleasure that you find in the world with the pleasure that you find in meditation.
Yeah.
For me, it's always been more the pleasure of right speech and right action. That was the first thing that I really got pleasure in, that got my addiction away from the pleasure in the world. my meditation practice has gone from being a chore to being at this point neutral. It hasn't quite gotten me to like real joy of meditation, but it's now to the point where I don't, you know, it's not like, oh God, I got to sit for another half an hour. So,
and that's a huge development, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. The frustration is out of it.
Yeah.
And then one day, you know, the pleasure will come into it too.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day. I'd like to hear from all of you, but let's keep it very, yes, Michael.
No, I was just going to say something. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know you want to keep things short, so I just want to make a short point before we get out of here.
All right, we'll go around the room. So yeah, let's just keep it to just, you know, maybe a few sentences, as best you can. I don't want to cut you short either, but it is 10 o'clock. Let me hear what Dad. Dad, how are you?
Oh, fine, John. Yeah, thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yep.
As you were reading through the Anapali Sutta, two words that you used, or that the Buddha used, over is trains oneself,
and
being sensitive to. In a lot of my experience before, there was always a subtle implication that you should attain some certain state of consciousness, and once you attain that certain state of consciousness, then you could practice the Dhamma.
Yep.
But that's, of course, not the way it is. And this being sensitive to and training oneself gives us the opportunity to take up this path. And that's very important, really. Thank you,
Fred. Yeah, we're not developing some abstract quality of mind. It's a direct experience of a calm, peaceful mind. So, Laura, good to see you. Finally.
Yeah,
oh, I can't believe it's been a year.
It's been a year. Wow. Yeah. To be here, and the teaching is just so multifaceted and kind of touches on all these places that one's mind can go in meditation, and kind of all, like, these checks and balances sort of for the different hindrances, and also, you know, then the framework and the guidelines. It was beautiful to listen to that. And, you know, I definitely am grateful to be here and hope to be coming to class more this year. But I'm also just amazed at the benefits of this particular practice that I've learned here. You know, I'm looking at these framed pieces up here, remembering being at that retreat and just how much strength that a meditation practice in a Sangha group can give you. And even though I haven't been to Sangha in a year and have that, my meditation practice at home has been very sporadic, these teachings like live with me daily. And our framework, and which I feel like calls to the fact that it's more than just a meditation practice. But I'm here because I'm having trouble with my practice, right? So my meditation practice, that is. And I can see that when that one aspect of the path isn't there, you know, it makes other aspects more difficult. So anyway, that's that. Much, much gratitude. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you for being here. Yeah, it is. It's a complete eightfold path. So. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning, John.
How'd you like my class, Evelyn Wood's class?
Well, I've got a thought that I've never had before, a realization that I've never had before, that to combat the ever monkey mind that we have, you know, that we were just the constant chatter and feelings and thoughts that we go have all the time in our heads. I haven't really thought about predicting them. In other words, kind of if you're at home, for example, you're going to walk into another room or another area, predict that you're going to have thoughts and feelings when you get there. And therefore, and when you get there, you could say, well, these are just the thoughts and feelings. So that you're not sort of like surprised by them, or you don't get caught up in them. You just, because you're expecting them. So, and then you walk into another, or you go upstairs or something. But before, when you're downstairs, you expect to have a monkey mind and thoughts and feelings when you're upstairs. Therefore, you wouldn't get in, you know, caught up in them, you know, because you're kind of expecting them.
Yeah.
Which is really just kind of like understanding what we're all going through in life. Yeah. It's like we all have thoughts and feelings, blah, blah, blah. And if you expect them to come, well then, oh yeah, this is my feeling when I'm here. This is my thought when I'm here. That's it.
Yeah.
You know? Wow. So it's just kind of like, that just might take the edge off and, you know, to the getting caught up in them. That's just what I was thinking whilst I was here.
Yeah, it's beautiful. What you're describing is you're understanding the quality of your mind and the way you think.
Mm-hmm.
You're becoming familiar with yourself, finally.
Yeah.
The Tibetan word for meditation is gom, G-O-M, and that's what it means. It means to become familiar with, and in that sense, it's become familiar with your own mind. And how else would we change our mind until we understood it, until we knew what it is, what it's doing, what it might do in the next moment when I get to that next room?
Yeah.
Because now I've taken the time to quiet down a little bit and just look at what's occurring in my mind, what it's bringing forth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Jen.
Morning. Thank you. Thank everyone. Thank you.
Thank
all.
You,
thank you.
Thank you.
Feeling a lot of gratitude today.
Thank you.
And the only thing that I want to say is that, just to keep it short, what came through for me today was you absolutely can control your mind.
Yes.
And I know I've heard you say it a million times, but it's like you just have to do it. Just do what you need to do, control your mind, and you can control it. Every time I try to explain it.
And you can control it, yes.
It's like it's in a conditioned, so I stop talking because I realize that it's like,
yeah,
your own conditioning will fall away if you control your mind.
Yep. Yeah. And there's the paradox and the conundrum, because you have to do it.
Right.
And you're going to have to do something within yourself that isn't rooted in eye-making.
It's very,
that's the
like,
tough, that's
it,
the,
it
that's
is,
the
like,
that
I'm starting to, like, feel like I'm not just being thrown around.
Yeah.
And, you know, start to, like, you see, oh, like and it is like you're taking responsibility for fully.
You learn what you want to think when you want to think it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for your brevity too. Oh, okay.
I'm grateful to be here too. I don't have anything.
I'm glad you're here. Hello, Tim.
Hello. I'm not going to really say much except I'm kind of in a high state of agitation from the sutta and recognize it, understand it, and to go further with it would be very self-referential, and I don't want to insult anyone. I don't want to talk about myself, but I'll email you.
Okay.
We'll go over it, but thank you.
Good. Or give me a call.
Yeah.
Hey, Anthony.
Good morning. I'll keep this brief also. To me, what's stood out about this was beyond all the lists and the numbering of things, and I don't know why the Buddha has such a fascination with numbers, but in any event,
it's a memorization tool.
Yeah, and it's very, and they're still very helpful today. I mean, you see it all over.
Yeah.
But to me, it just emphasized that it's not enough to study the Dharma. You have to also apply it on the cushion.
Yeah.
And this was like a roadmap or a manual of all the things that can arise, but it basically comes down to the simple instruction of whatever arises, just come back to the breath.
Yeah.
But even more than that, it ties in the importance of the support of the Sangha.
Oh, yeah.
Because even the Dharma and the meditation isn't enough. You need the support of the Sangha.
Yeah.
So that's what I took out of this.
Yeah, thank you. And the three refuges are represented in the sutta, aren't they? The Buddha's teaching, his Dhamma is there, and they had this original Sangha that allowed all this to establish itself in the world and to flourish. Thank you. Kevin, good morning.
John, good to see you. Nice to see everybody. Happy New Year.
Good New Year.
Really appreciate, you going through this sutta, especially at the end of this long study we've done, and I think it just really reaffirms that this is an internal practice and an internal cultivation we're doing, and it really describes the concentration that we do individually. And I think sort of what I don't know him anything else besides Jason, so I will learn his new name. What he was referring to is sort of this mindfulness, which is sort of the where we take the concentration into the world. That's our state of our mindfulness is as we're reacting or as we're involved, with this world that's aflame. And back to what Jen said, that we have control over this, and to take a different sort of metaphor, and while it is as insidious as an addiction, we are sort of made of a flammable material, and this concentration informing the mindfulness as we are out in the world, it's as if we're stopping this point of contact, just burning our finger instead of our whole arm, our whole body lighting on fire. And that's how quickly and sort of nefarious this conditioning can take hold. So it just describes that this is an internal process, an internal work that we're going to do, that we follow this sutta, and this is a sutta for a lifetime. This is one, if you're uncomfortable, Tim, I am too. I need to go read it again. And this is your work. You go read this, you practice, you'll notice your mindfulness when you're out in the world, and we'll all be here to support each other when we keep going on this path. So thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Hello, Becky.
Hello, thank you. Just going to say I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to have heard this sutta again. Just really echoing what everyone else said, that it is so good to be reminded that you are in control, but you have to put in the work, and this is how you do it. And it's nice to hear the Buddha tell you that all of these things are going to happen to try to thwart you. And it's good to have those enumerated so that you can be aware and not be hard on yourself. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Beck. Trevor, how are you?
Hi, thank you so much for the teaching today. And I wanted to really thank Tim, too, for sharing so honestly about the struggle. It's really helpful to hear these different perspectives and experiences. Just a quick question of clarification. I had thought, I was kind of thinking most fabrications were mental, so it was interesting to hear body fabrications. I was just wondering if you could clarify.
Sure.
The difference between the mental and body.
Important. Thanks for the question. The Buddha teaches there's three fabrications. There's mental fabrications, verbal fabrications, and bodily fabrications. That's simply the way we are as human beings. We think, and if our thinking is rooted in ignorance, it's a mental fabrication. We tend to talk. Some people talk a lot. And if that talking is rooted in ignorance, it's a verbal fabrication. And our body does things. Sometimes it does things outwardly. Sometimes it simply feels things inwardly. But if that bodily actions are rooted in ignorance, it's a bodily fabrication. It's just a clear description of where fabrications arise, so we know where to deal with them, which is as a human being. Thank you. It was a great question.
Yeah. Can I add to that? Is the Buddha also referring to, like, when you might feel itchy or tingling around your body or disturbing or pain or disturbing sensations while you're meditating? Because I get that.
And in that sense, it's being the sensation in the body isn't the fabrication. It's the way we think and feel and react to it.
Right.
And it might be, oh, I'm trying to meditate. How can I have this? That's a fabrication. That's a reaction to wanting something to be different than it is, rather than just continue to meditate and notice that there's pain. Mm-hmm. Noticing that the pain is not a fabricated view. It's a self-centered reaction, self-referential reaction that would be fabricated. So thanks for bringing that up. It's an important point. We can get confused.
John.
Yes, Tatane.
Just a quick, I'm curious of tag teaming his point. When you say a bodily fabrication would be like, say, for example, you're in a family and the actions that you do is creating more suffering in the family. They mm-hmm. react to you, you react to them, and you begin to create this mire of suffering
yep. Yep.
because of like ignorance. So would you say that that's also an example of a bodily fabrication? I'm just curious.
Yes, it is. And a reason why it's so important to recognize it as a fabrication and not as a fact of life is because then we can diminish it and eventually let go of that behavior. If we're still seeing it as a proper response, the fabrication, what it might be, we'll defend an argument that we might have had with our spouse or our kids or something like that. That's continuing the fabrication instead of recognizing it as a bodily fabrication. If it's a disturbance in the mind, in our speech, or within our body in any way, it's a fabrication. How do we know? How can we tell the difference between a fabrication and something that is real? Because it's not causing a reaction in the moment. We are able to stay present with it without any self-reference. And that's not a magical or mystical place. It's simply being an awakened human being. It seems almost unattainable to a self-referential ego self, but it's the only way to live a natural life, to use the word. It's the only way to be a human being. So thank you. Great questions. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
See you, Tom. It's great to be here. And thank you for completing this cycle.
Not quite. Tuesday's
it. Yeah, I won't be able to be here Tuesday, but it's just been phenomenal and so complete. It's everything we need. And to thank the Sangha for all the contribution that, you know, that I get to hear and absorb every time I come here.
Remarkable.
And that this really is a complete teaching. This is. It's,
yep.
It's the Dharma. It's, there's nothing beyond it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy New Year to all the roaches, please. Hello, Julia.
Hello, John. Just to reiterate what Jen said, that we can control our mind. In the Buddha's time, they didn't have scientific evidence, but nowadays we have scientific evidence that actually shows, you know, people that meditate, the longer they meditate, the more their brain wave patterns are synchronized.
Yeah.
The more your brain wave patterns are synchronized, of course, you know, it shows that you're able to focus better, better concentration. The more you're able to focus, of course, you have less stress in your life because you deal with things as they come and as they roll away. So there is proof. So it's not just something that's, you know, in the Buddhist time, they had the examples of people that were enlightened beings. Yeah. But in our time, we have also evidence, you know, scientific evidence that can back it up. It proves that you can control your mind and your thoughts. You know? So,
yeah, thank you.
It's interesting, you know.
There is. There's, for many years now, they've been quite a few studies that show that, in general, mindfulness meditation, just, you know, the modern term for it, brings great benefit to people. And that's true. You know, by me saying that the Buddha only taught one meditation doesn't imply that that other meditation methods are useless. They can be a distraction against what the Buddha teaches, but they bring great benefit to people. You know, so, I mean, and when you think about that simple act of whatever your meditation method might be, at the very least in that moment, it's kind of bringing you back into your body. So there's great benefit to it. And this is a way to rather look at the world as trying to reduce the stress that's inherent in the world to completely eliminate my response to stress. And that's a significant difference. So thank you. Michael, finally got to you. Sorry to keep you waiting.
It's going to take me about at least probably an hour and a half.
We got time.
I'm on show.
We're going to do this again on Tuesday, too.
I agree with what Kevin was saying. This is it's internal, it's introspective, it's deeply introspective.
Yep.
Okay? Drowsiness, when we're meditating to address the young man who's speaking on the... I'm sure everyone here has experienced drowsiness, you know, during meditation. everything as it occurs is point of contact. Okay, everything as it occurs, even like you say, like, okay, you're getting drowsy when you're meditating. That's a point of contact. So we have to discern the reasons that why is this occurring. Obviously, okay, it's like it's something that occurs. You know, maybe we're, you know, we're sitting the wrong way. Maybe we're in a reclined position. Maybe we're we've eaten a big meal, whatever it is, but you discern the reason for why this is occurring, and yeah. you manage it. That's what I would think, anyhow. Again, I look at things in life is everything is a point of contact. Okay, anything that unfolds before us, whether it's pleasant or painful, it's a point of contact. Okay, and again, this goes far deep into our psyche, you know,
yep.
And that's the introspective part of things. I also like, and again, I don't like using I, but for the sake of like trying to make this more clear, it's like I love, again, going back to the sutta, the Bhatiya, or what's
Bhatiya Sutta.
Bhatiya. But anyhow, like what is heard is only heard, what is seen is only seen, what is sensed is only sensed, and what is only cognized. Nothing is personal. Nothing is personal.
Yep.
It comes, it happens. If it's disfavorable to us, well, then we look through the lens of the Eightfold Path, and that's the way we deal with everything we come across in life, you know, and I don't know. And obviously, the important part there too, is the concentration that is developed there in jhana.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that concentration enables us to have, this is the word, you know, this word you use, and I love this this concept of penetrating discernment. We're able to see the truth. We're able to, you know, work our way towards the truth.
Yeah.
You know, after we recognize, we restrain, and then, you know, during this our process of penetrative discernment is occurring. And then we know what's the right way to go in that particular moment.
Yeah. Thank you. The a mind that's lacking concentration is a mind that's taking everything personal. And if you find that you're distracted in the moment, it's because you're taking something personal. And so this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And it's directly reminding ourselves, as a Buddha taught here. It's a direct practice. We do it. We learn to think correctly. And from that thinking correctly, we learn to act correctly. Sign of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. Amanda, welcome to our Sangha.
Thank you. I don't have anything to add, but thank you for today.
I'm glad you joined us. I hope you join again. Yeah, it's gotten a little late, so we'll end our class just to remind it that this will conclude on Tuesday, and then a week from today we'll start our Truth of Happiness Dhamma study for 12 weeks. I think that's it. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. Give me a moment to pull it up. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And again, these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, excuse me, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dathane. Thank you, Thad. We'll see you soon. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.